We are honored to shout out another Jewish podcast that we love, The Bagel Report, by featuring one of its episodes as a bonus episode here on our feed. A podcast produced by Jay, the Jewish News of Northern California, and Jewfolk, The Bagel Report is a pop culture entertainment podcast featuring award-winning culture and entertainment writers Esther D. Kostanowitz and Aaron Ben Moshe. Each episode, they discuss all things Jewish in the arts and entertainment world, while exploring how Jewish identity is portrayed on the big and small screen. You can listen in by searching The Bagel Report in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your podcasts. In this episode entitled The Mandalorian Report, they dive into the extremely Jewish themes of Disney Plus's hit Star Wars show, The Mandalorian.
This is The Bagel Report, a podcast exploring Jewish representation and identity in popular culture, with your hosts Esther Kostanowitz and Aaron Ben Moshe, and now a production of Jay, the Jewish News of Northern California. Aaron?
Hey, Esther.
Hey. Boy, what an episode we have for you today.
I'm so excited for everyone to hear it.
We had guests. We had a robust discussion. We talked pop culture, Jewish life, Israel. What didn't we talk about, really?
Honestly, this might be the most fandomy episode of The Bagel Report we've ever had. And we did an entire episode on Marvel.
That's true. You know, I think also this was integrative. Like, we talked about The Mandalorian, which is really the purpose for our being here, to talk about Jewish aspects of The Mandalorian. The last episode of The Mandalorian, season 3, aired recently, and it capped a season which was filled with names, moments, and ideas that seemed to draw from Jewish sources, whether intentionally or unintentionally. So if you're a regular listener, you know that I'm the fan of Star Wars and applying a Jewish lens to the franchise. And Aaron is more of a casual fan of Star Wars, but like really does enjoy this interpretive lens as well, wouldn't you say?
The biggest understatement of the year is that I am a casual Star Wars fan. My husband is a fan. I've made him Star Wars themed gifts over the years, but I truly had a crash course this last few weeks prepping for this episode. And I've learned a ton, and I do have like a new respect for the Enterprise, which I know is a Star Trek word, but
That's right.
Do feel like the entire franchise does have a more Jewish lens the more I started watching The Mandalorian, which is exciting.
And I think it's appropriate that you use the term Enterprise, even though it is a Star Trek term, because one of the things that we did is we definitely referenced Star Trek and Marvel and Harry Potter, and like all of the fandoms had little pieces of representation in this episode, even though it was mostly about The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. So whatever we observe about popular culture, we could always say more and go deeper. You guys know this about us. That's probably why you're here.
And we noticed.
Yes, you noticed. I noticed. Aaron noticed. We had two guests who joined us today, and they were David A.M. Walensky and Rabbi Howard Tillman. So, Aaron, why don't you give us a little bit of a bio on David?
So David is an editor at The Jay, the Jewish News of Northern California, and one of the producers of this podcast. David has many fandoms. Star Trek is his biggest. He's the founder of the Star Trek Jew Posting Group on Facebook, which is so much fun. I am a part of it, and it's really great. But he has a considerable connection to the Star Wars universe as well. The special editions and later the prequels were major events in his childhood, and he remains a devoted fan of the franchise.
That is for sure. We were lucky to have his vast knowledge on the podcast today. Also with us was Rabbi Howard Tillman. Rabbi Howard Tillman is a rabbi at Congregation Beth Israel in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. He came to the synagogue in 2017 and embraced the community through partnerships with professional staff and lay leadership. He has worked to invigorate the synagogue in the realm of religious services, educational opportunities, and family programming. And Rabbi Tillman loves spending time with the congregation's many learners of all ages, bringing modern and classical perspectives as well as humor to his teachings. And the reason that we have him on the podcast today is because he was referred to on a podcast that David and I both listen to that does deep dives on The Mandalorian as well as other TV franchises. And on this podcast, The Ringer versus House of Our podcast, one of the hosts read a letter from Rabbi Tillman, and I thought it was so great that I reached out to him to bring him on to this podcast. So it was great to have him. He had a lot to say, obviously. And obviously, this episode contains spoilers for all episodes of The Mandalorian. That's three seasons, all of which are available on Disney Plus, as well as the episodes of The Book of Boba Fett that feature The Mandalorian, which you can look up if you'd like. But there's two episodes toward the end of the season of The Book of Boba Fett that really are very Mandalorian focused, and you get some good Grogu action, as they like to say. There are also, it's also spoilers for whatever happens in Rebels and The Clone Wars, which are two animated series also available on Disney Plus that focus on this time frame. And we're releasing this the week of May the 4th. So May the 4th be with you. And let's bring on our guests.
Enjoy.
Hello. We already heard their bios, but we want you to know their voices as well. So let's do one of those old school Mickey Mouse Club greetings. And I'm sure I'm the only person who knows what that is. But basically, it's just that we say our name and that's it. So just so you get to know our voices. I'm Esther.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Howard.
And I'm David.
So we've got a lot on our agenda today. And it's, you know, there have been a number of other places where this concept has been discussed. The fact that this season of The Mandalorian, that The Mandalorian in general and the season of The Mandalorian has been extremely Jewish, Jew adjacent, however we'd like to articulate it. So we've asked ourselves questions like, are Mandalorians Maccabees, for instance, because they did rededicate their temple or, you know, the forge, if you are being accurate, and they relit it. And also like Hanukkah, it was a story of a victory of fewer people over many people. So you can make a case for that. Anything else, Aaron?
Yeah. And are Mandalorians a stand-in for the exiled Jewish people? And what can we learn about faith in diaspora, about the destruction and reclamation of a homeland, about how different adherents of some faith interact with each other and with their history?
Right. So there's a lot in there. And to add to that, in the calendar where we are right now, we are recording the week of Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's Memorial Day and Independence Day, respectively. They are 2 days that are enjoined by like the sorrow and the gladness, which I think is really very interesting, just Jewishly, to try to acknowledge that those two things can exist in the same space. And the week that we're releasing this is May the 4th, which may resonate with some of you as May the 4th be with you, aka Star Wars Day. As we note every year, there is a machloket. There's an argument about what day is really Star Wars Day, which, you know, goes back to the very beginning of the 1977.
I think the May the 4th thing is cute. It's great. It's good. Like Disney has made it like a big like annual branding opportunity, and they can have a sale and blah, blah, blah. And that's great for them. But like May, whatever the other day,
21st,
yes, I think. 1977 feels like real, like the day that Star Wars arrived in the world.
Can I propose a compromise?
Yes.
I think it's appropriate to say that this is the May. Like why only a day when not a full month?
Oh, this is the May.
And he has spoken. So there we go.
That's right. You know, I think that's, you know, this is a very interesting conversation because we haven't even really started to talk about Mando, and already we're seeing different interpretations of the same things emerge. So from this, we learned that David doesn't like sales on Disney and merchandise, and that he thinks it's, you know, that the authentic day is the original day.
Let it never
day,
be said that I'm against
a fundamentalist.
I'm not against sales, friends. I own Disney merchandise. I'm a fan of sales.
Good. Okay. So just so we're clear on that.
Perhaps a gimmick. Perhaps he is not a fan of the gimmick.
I don't like cute gimmicks.
There it is.
So then we can presume you're not a fan of Revenge of the Fifth.
I'm not.
Okay, we don't have time to unpack all this. No. And moving on, I would just like to disclose that I am a new Star Wars fan. Esther is the true Star Wars fan, and I came to it later, which is really great if you're my husband, who is like, finally.
Mazel tov to him.
And if you're like me and you've mostly stuck to the first, or not the first, but the original three movies, and you haven't even dived in to the animated things, goodness, you probably have missed some things and have a few questions. And even if you did see everything like I did, you still have questions. So, okay, let's start with some history. Like, what or who is a Mandalorian? Or if you're like me and Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy, what or why is a Mandalorian?
That's cross-pollinating the fandoms, just in case somebody here was like, I don't really like Star Wars, but I wish there was a Marvel reference. Okay, thanks,
I'm here for you. And so what happened when Mandalore was destroyed? And who is Bo-Katan? And why is she important? And why can she sometimes take off her helmet when other people can't take off their helmet? And also, why is this night different than all other nights? Anyway, David, if you can please enlighten us. If we haven't seen the Rebels or the Clone Wars or maybe even Boba Fett, what did we miss?
I think it's really important to start with the armor, because the armor is the whole thing. Okay, so the Mandalorians are this warrior race. They don't look like aliens. They're humans. But they have this proud and ancient warrior culture and an obsession with their very distinctive armor. And in a way, in the real world, in the history of, you know, how these stories came to be in real life, the Mandalorians basically are just a suit of armor. It starts as a piece of concept art for a new kind of stormtrooper for Empire Strikes Back in the late 70s. Originally, it's all white, the way that the classic stormtroopers are. And eventually, there isn't room for that in the story, but a bounty hunter gets introduced into the story named Boba Fett, and they repurpose this drawing of this cool armor, give it some different colors, and they create the character of Boba Fett. He's got like three lines in Empire Strikes Back, but he looks dope. He looks so cool. I think one of the reasons that as they've been fleshed out, especially in The Mandalorian, that they've resonated with a lot of Jews or people who are familiar with Jewish issues is, frankly, the like rank factionalism that constantly divides their society.
Okay, say more about that, because I think that that's what we're going to need.
Yeah, so I think that is the crucial thing here. But I just want to be clear. I mean, whenever there are these discussions about how Jewish something is in one of the fandoms that I'm engaged with, I always want to be clear that I think one of the reasons it feels so Jewish is that it's also so universal. You know, anybody from any culture has an experience of like factionalism or sectarianism. Or, you know, even if it's just like Methodists making jokes about like different types of Methodists, we can all see that in The Mandalorian. So I just want to say that like we're all Jews here. So like that's the angle that we're looking at this sectarianism and factionalism. But it's not the only way to look at it.
100%. I've also done some panels with folks from different faiths where we talked about the impact of Star Wars on us as children of within that faith. And also as we developed our faith lenses, we applied it to this thing that we loved. So I think that, and there was a lot of opportunity for building understanding, et cetera. And I think one of the things that we should keep in mind is that George Lucas, remember him, back in the day when he was creating Star Wars and its universe, he wanted to include all of these different faiths. So he created in the Force and in the Jedi this opportunity to have anyone of any faith look at this world and see something that they could relate to.
Yeah, yeah. The Clone Wars animated series does a number of episodes set on Mandalore. And most of the Mandalorians there are part of a society known as the New Mandalorians, who are pacifists. Their planet has been so ravaged by sectarian conflict between different groups of Mandalorians, different clans, different factions for so long. The planet is borderline uninhabitable, and they live in these domed cities. And the faction that is in control, led by the Duchess Satine Kryze, are the new Mandalorians, and they're pacifists. And they are trying to build a new society that is not going to further destroy the world that they live in. But old divisions run deep. There are factions that are still more warlike that have been exiled to nearby moons and planets. And those groups really give rise to the factions that are most prominent in The Mandalorian, our real topic today.
I think it's also a good point to emphasize here that, you know, like you said, the first time we see a Mandalorian, it's Boba Fett and he's like this bounty hunter. That's not what it is to be a Mandalorian. There's so much more, as we're explaining here.
Yeah. So as the Empire comes to power, Mandalore, the Mandalorian homeworld, becomes occupied. And there have been, at that point, like a number of sectarian changeovers. But at this point, essentially, the Empire commits genocide, makes the planet even more uninhabitable than it was before. And the few Mandalorians who are left are either, you know, off-world or escape, whatever. And the important factions that we come to know later on, of course, have their roots in these earlier periods. But one of the things that confused people at the beginning of the first season of The Mandalorian is that earlier, some Mandalorians wear helmets, some don't. And the ones who do, they take them off sometimes to like have conversations and like emote with their faces on screen. And yet Din Djarin, the main character of The Mandalorian, is like, no, no. True Mandalorians never remove their helmets in front of other people. Honestly, from those first couple episodes and from that first thing, it was the first time that I was having like Jewy thoughts about the series, because I was like, oh, you're telling me there's an ethno-religious group where, get this, there are different factions who have different thoughts about headwear. And I was like, okay, this is familiar territory, folks. And people having such a hard time with it. And I'm like, yeah, it's a whole culture.
If you could just tell us in a sentence, what is Death Watch? Who are the Night Owls? Who are the Children of the Watch? Because those are the three that I think will confuse the people the most if they haven't watched the animated series.
Right. So that's Din and his fundamentalists who don't remove their helmets are members of a group called Children of the Watch, who evolved from an earlier, very warlike but less fundamentalist group called Death Watch. And the Children of the Watch seem to be particularly interested in taking in what they call foundlings, people who may not be Mandalorians, who they adopt into their culture. They are very concerned with a kind of ritual purity that comes from officially proclaiming their creed in a public ritual and then never removing their helmets in public after that. And they have an exclusionary attitude of like, only Mandalorians who live the way that we do are true Mandalorians. I mean, they are a truly fundamentalist group.
I think what's even need to talk about, like, where they descended from, like Children of the Watch.
Right.
We're all assuming that's Children of Death Watch. And Death Watch, I mean, you can maybe make a case of to view Death Watch favorably, but I mean, are Death Watch terrorists? Probably. I mean, they set off bombs in public areas on Mandalore, nearly killing Obi-Wan Kenobi, nearly killing Duchess Satine Kryze, Bo-Katan's sister. And let's also not forget, Bo-Katan is kind of the number two in this Death Watch. If you asked her and you asked Death Watch, they talk about their principles is being in touch with the warrior history of Mandalore, and we're rebelling against kind of the pacifist movements of New Mandalore that you're talking about. But I mean, these guys are violent. They, as you said, want to really violently take back Mandalore.
Yes, certainly. And they had, I think, a less religious quality to them then. I think you're right to characterize them as a terrorist group or a paramilitary organization or something. But they do have a devotion to what they think of as the older and the truer, more warlike Mandalore. Duchess Satine, the leader of the pacifists in this earlier period, has a younger sister, Bo-Katan Kryze, who's now a live action character on The Mandalorian. And she is with Death Watch for a while. She later starts a somewhat more moderate group called the Night Owls, who go through a variety of allegiances. But essentially, they are not opposed necessarily to Satine's pacifism, but they are also generally in pursuit of a more settled and orderly Mandalore, less riven by conflict. But by the time of The Mandalorian, Satine is this failed former leader who couldn't protect Mandalore from the Imperials. Her homeworld, as far as she knows, is basically uninhabitable. And what's left of the Night Owls are, like we said, under the, you know, in this Imperial era, have just kind of become mercenaries.
Sorry, I just think one of the most interesting things about all of this is these divisions, that if you asked any of these core groups, they truly believe they are true Mandalorian. But to the viewer, we're seeing three varying differences, and it's honestly kind of confusing. And I'm like, oh, this is Judaism. This is exactly it. And it's even more interesting, going back to one of the other points you said earlier, is that the first time you see a Mandalorian, you see one type of person, and then all of a sudden we get an entire show where you see an entire full-fledged, colorful land of, oh, there's multiple types of Mandalorian. And Esther, doesn't that sound familiar? Kind of like what we do every week at the Bagel Report, yeah, where we take one thing and we go, wow, this is how they're taking it. And now all of a sudden we get time to expand and see all these different other types of beings.
Right. I love that. I love the division stuff is very much, unfortunately, resonant. And we could have conversations about who is a nationalist, who is a terrorist, who is just trying to get their land back. You know, there's a lot in there that we could approach, and maybe we will in a little bit, but I want to get us back on track. So I want to thank you, David, for the crash course in denominations of a fictional race of people. So thank you. Thank you for that. And so now I want to just talk about our Mando moments, which doesn't mean our moments when we understood who Din Djarin was as a Mandalorian, but when we actually locked into this idea of the Mandalorian's journey as a Jewish journey. So I remember the first time I was wondering if I was seeing things and hearing things, or if maybe I was just so Jewy that my Jewishness like crossed into the television and Jon Favreau was like, yes, let's just use it. But for me, it was the episodes of the Book of Boba Fett, where we got basically the prescription for Teshuvah, for redemption, after Din Djarin goes away from the way, which we have all interpreted as being off the derech, meaning like off the path of being, you know, the righteous in your faith, and or halacha, the Jewish way of going, of walking. And he removes his kippah, I mean his helmet, and then has to pure, in order to be accepted back into his tribe, he has to purify himself in the living waters, which I thought was just, you know, what a phrase. We know that comes from the mikvah language. And he has to purify himself in the living waters of the Mandalorian mikvah, whatever it is. They don't call it a mikvah, but we know better. We also have the armor who says things that I felt maybe could have been lifted directly from Jewish text. Though we were scattered to the winds, our adherence to the way has preserved our legacy for the generations until someday we return to our homeland. And then I started seeing it everywhere. And there were a couple of people I was able to discuss it with, but then I tuned into the House of R podcast on the Ringerverse Network, which David and I are huge fans of and listen to all the time. I love the dynamic on that show. And then lo and behold, they had a letter from a Rabbi Howard Tillman.
Surprise.
Who is you. It's you. But But yeah, I think that, you know, hearing of a Judaism corner that they started with your, thanks to your letters, which were brought together these two areas of cultural specificity. So I loved hearing your name there. And then I'm glad that you can come here and help us out with some additional commentary today. So tell us about your Mando moments.
Yeah, I think there were a few of them. And also another shout out to House of R. It's a huge honor that my name was mentioned, that my emails were read by Johanna and Mallory on the podcast. I may or may not have saved the clip of Johanna saying that Rabbi Tillman is crushing it everywhere. I may or may not, you know, add that to my, you know, to my
everywhere.
Demo somewhere.
Yeah. Highlight for sure.
I think so. Maybe Twitter bio. I think it might have to go, you know, go that far as well. You know, I think a lot of the moments you mentioned really started the journey, bathing in the living waters. I know Jews aren't the only people who have a ritual of purification in water. Like, let's not kid ourselves there. But you're right, seeing the living waters, the Mayim Chayim, that kind of made a bell go off in my head. Then as we started this newest season, season three, in that first episode when they present the shard that was supposedly recovered from the surface of Mandalore, written in the Mandoa font, which is different than the Auerbach font. I can't claim to read either of these myself. But if you know where to look, you can find guides and find YouTube videos where people explain what they say. And seeing that shard was actually a quote from the Book of Exodus. At one point, the armorer says to Din Djarin, redemption is no longer possible since the destruction of our homeworld. When I was watching that episode, I actually took a picture of that and just like, I sent that, you know, obviously with the captions on, because who can watch TV without them? And I took a picture of that, sent it to a friend of mine. And like, is this about Mandalore culture or is this about Judaism? And that kind of begun this journey, because that's straight out of, it's almost literally straight out of the Talmud, this idea that for so long our people were looked to Jerusalem, looked to the temple for our atonement. You made a mistake, you committed a sin. How did you redeem yourself? You brought a sacrifice, you offered it in the temple, and you were good to go. I'm simplifying here, but I think the point carries. But once that's destroyed, once the temple is no more, how is redemption possible? How is atonement possible? In our world, we became a Judaism that's based much more in a synagogue than in the temple, than the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. And we turn more to prayer than to sacrifice. Instead of atonement at the temple, we have a day of atonement. We have Yom Kippur, and we find redemption through teshuvah, through tefillah and tzedakah. I think that was one of the first moments for me. Then I think it was in the second episode of this season, which, by the way, is chapter 18. You know, 18. I think maybe there's something there as well.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is where Bo is
Disney
explaining.
Disney sitting up there somewhere being like, guys, we have got to get the Jewiest episode in on Chai, okay?
And then Walt Disney's
and
like, no!
That's right. That's right. Walt Disney's frozen anti-Semitic head somewhere is crying out. I think this is really interesting about the loss of the temple, and because Din, more than he needs a kosher mikveh, his real issue is he has to make a sin offering and no temple. No sin offering. He can't do it. These guys need rabbinic Judaism is what they need.
They need more denominations of Mandalorianism. They need maybe a conservative Mandalorianism.
Go. That's the real Jewish prescription for these people. More denominations.
Right, because it works so well for us.
I think they want like a conservadox, right? So they don't have to be so militant, but they can still be, you know, believe in the origin of their people and, you know, the things that their grandparents held in high regard and held sacred. So maybe there's something there.
But I want to hear about this episode 18 because it definitely didn't occur to me. I thought we were just going in order here. And now that you're saying it, I'm like, okay, there it is. There's the Jewishness.
So that's the episode where Din goes back to Mandalore and finds out it's not, in fact, toxic and you can go there. And he finds his way down to the living waters already and is captured by the mecha spider thing and is rescued by Grogu, which is amazing. And as Bo is coming to rescue him there, she explains that Moff Gideon, kind of the villain of the series, that he tried to, the Empire set out to punish us, to wipe away our memory. Now, to make this episode even more Jewy, I believe that episode aired about 3 days, I think the week of Purim. So 3 days after Shabbat Zachor, which is when we read from Sefer Dvarim, the book of Deuteronomy, Therefore, in the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies in that land. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. So this idea of blotting out memory as, yes, a way of wiping out an entire people, that's very much present there. And I saw that and I'm like, okay, again, this is not like run-of-the-mill Jewish content here. This is not just about, oh, wearing a helmet and, you know, finding redemption in water. Maybe there's something more. And then I think we found towards the end of the season when Bo, I think a lot of the center is on Bo-Katan. When she's talking at the end of the season that Mandalorians are always stronger together and that what has really brought them down has been their infighting against each other, against all the different sects and the groups that David was explaining. And that too sounds a lot like this Second Temple period for Judaism. When we talk about this around Tisha B'Av a lot, you know, why was the Second Temple destroyed? Because of Sinat Chinam, because of senseless hatred that took place among all the different groups, all the different sects of Judaism around that time. And there is tremendous power to this idea that for any group, we're much more powerful when we're united, when we don't spend our time fighting against each other. Maybe we can fight back against the Romans, or maybe here we can fight back against the empire.
Yeah, and you get this vibe, I think, in episode 18, when you're talking about, you know, at the beginning of the episode, Din goes to visit Bo-Katan. He wants her to come with him down to the surface of Mandalore. And she's in this not ruined castle that she lives in, but there's no one there. And she's just kind of like lounging badassishly in, you know, in this like big stony chair. I had a memory, and I can't think if it's a specific midrash or poem or something I'm thinking of people sort of sitting in the ruins of Jerusalem, and it's depopulated, and, you know, God is gone, the magic is gone. And she really has that feeling because she's been through all these conflicts, all these fights, and she now she says to Din, I believe in that scene, essentially like, man, we screwed up that planet. There's nothing left down there because of all of this like endless fighting that she used to participate in, but now sees as the Sinat Chinam.
That midrash kind of stuck in my mind also. I felt like something was familiar. I couldn't quite place it. The closest thought I have was to a midrash where I believe it's Rabbi Akiva is wandering in the ruins of Jerusalem, ruins of the temple, and sees, I think it's, I want to say a fox. It could be other some similar kind of rodentish animal to it.
Foxes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he sees them there. And then he says, that's actually a sign that things are going to be okay, because as part of the prophecy that one day foxes will roam through a ruined temple. But then the next line of the prophecy that comes out of Nevi'im, that the temple will be rebuilt. We will return to our homeland. So that's the moment that kind of stuck in my mind too, as we do see them walking through those ruins of Sundari a few times.
Yeah, where indeed there are some critters still alive. They're not cute like foxes, but, you know, they're there.
I mean, one of the things that that they talked about on the House of R, and they always talk about, is how the Mandalorians always pick like the most dangerous places to live. Like they have like flying velociraptors and giant alligators coming out of the lake trying to swallow their B'nai Mitzvah. You know, I just like that's just, they didn't say the B'nai Mitzvah part. That was me. But the idea,
definitely thought that.
Yes. So, I think one of the things that kind of came up for me is, how much do we think this is like intentional by the storytellers, which is, you know, storytellers are writ large, Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau. And Jon Favreau, as we all probably know, is Jewish. He grew up, his mother was Jewish, his father was Catholic of Italian and French-Canadian ancestry. And he had dropped out of Hebrew school to pursue acting, but after his mother's death, he had a bar mitzvah. His company that he produced, his production company, is called Golem Creations, which, you know, the golem being the protector of the villages in Eastern Europe that was made of clay. Almost any non-Jewish TV show that deals in the supernatural will eventually have a golem present.
Oh, wow. That was
a great X-Files episode.
I'm just Googling the logo of Golem. Golem Creations is the name of his production company.
Yeah.
And yeah, the logo is like yeah, definitely like a direct reference to like the traditional depiction of the Golem of Prague.
And I don't think it's intentional that one of those episodes aligns with Purim, right? I think that just I'm sure happens to be a happy accident. But then how exciting is it when it does align and there is that extra care that goes into an episode where you're like, you're taking a picture and sending it to your friend going, it doesn't get more on the nose than this.
Every time I wrote one of these emails or had these thoughts, I wrote in there like, you know, I don't think Jon Favreau was sitting down with a Masechet of Talmud in front of him and being like, oh, how can I use this story in the Mandalorian universe? Like, that's not happening. There's no way he's actually doing that. I'd love to be proven wrong, but there's no way that's actually happening. But I mean, isn't that what all art, isn't that what all media is about? Is that it's put out there and then we can interpret it through our own lenses. We can read into it our texts and pieces of our heritage and cultures that we know. But some of these are just so present that it's almost hard to avoid. It's almost hard to not think about.
And of course, this is one of like, this is one of the classic games that we play in the Jewish press in this country where we look at work by a Jewish artist, you know, whether it's a writer or a director or an actor or whatever. And we know they're Jewish and we ask, okay, well, is there something Jewish about this work that we can like tease out and write about? And sometimes I'm skeptical, right? Because sometimes you go and you then interview that author and they're like, yeah, well, like the themes of like Tikkun Olam and stuff. And you're like, okay, fine. So we're having this interview and that's fine. Whatever. But there are deeper, more resonant themes here. And I think you're right that he's not sitting down with, you know, a Masechet of Talmud. He's not like, yes, the foxes that Akiva saw in the ruins. But if indeed he's a guy who, like, after his mom died, he, you know, Jon Favreau goes and like has a bar mitzvah, like this has some kind of meaning to him. And there are stories that he has read and encountered through that have made some kind of impact on him. And they seem very present in this show.
Yes. But I would like to challenge the idea of why not? Like, why not he picked up a book or he has, you know, Talmud or Google in front of him to go, there's this story I remember hearing. I wonder if this plays an important role. Like, it just in my experience, I was the public school kid all the way up. I went to Hebrew school as a kid. Wasn't like I was involved, but I couldn't retain everything. And it wasn't until college where I started seeking information and stories and questions. And that's when I really got fascinated with the deeper meanings of the Bible and the Talmud and all these stories and all this Jewish history. And that's when I started noticing it in other places. And I wondered, okay, if this is me, I didn't go to Jewish day school. I wasn't brought up Orthodox, but yet I was finding it. Like, why not Jon Favreau coming to this and going, like I may not go to shul or temple or synagogue every weekend, but I am finding meaning in this medium. And I want to bring that to the land of Star Wars.
I'd love that to be the case. I think it's certainly possible. I think it's a beautiful notion. But I think you just really have to look for it. These are not the stories you learn in Hebrew school. This is not kind of the, you know, I had a bar mitzvah and I gave a speech for my Torah portion. And then I brought it back to the TV show I'm working on 20 years later. Like, this is, you know, real nitty gritty stuff. This is not stuff that every person of a Jewish background, however involved they are going to know about. When I wrote some of this, when I had conversations with these, I would find people who are engaged Jewishly and just aren't familiar with these stories. And that's fine. It's a wide canon. There's a lot of Talmud. There's a lot of Midrash. There's even just the Tanakh itself, even the Bible there's a lot that happens in it that many Jews don't know about, aren't as familiar with. And again, that's fine. We should all strive to do more, but everyone comes at it from a different place. So that's the part that really makes me wonder, you know, where does all this come from? When it's not kind of the surface level stuff that we're so used to seeing reflected in media that's either intentionally Jewish or vaguely Jewish, but this was much deeper, which really makes us think about it.
On the House of R, I think it was Mallory Rubin who said that there was this story about how on set, Jon Favreau like broke, they shut down production for the Seder. And so I think that indicates that there is some definite connection to Jewish culture and to Jewish symbols and meaning. And that together with the fact that the shard bore something from Exodus, which, you know, is where the Exodus takes place, hence the name. So I think that that is very possible, that there is some of that in there somewhere. And if Jon Favreau is listening, I'm terrified that Jon Favreau is listening to us. But secondarily
don't be terrified
to that, please.
Esther, the greatest thing, I'm telling you, the greatest thing that could happen to this episode of The Bagel Report is for Jon Favreau to listen to it.
Oh, I know. And it's clearly not going to happen, but we would be happy to have you on the podcast just
we'll
to represent your
it.
Own work, Jon.
Manifest.
Yeah, we'll attack
we'd love
from
to see
multiple
it.
Angles. You know, we'll ask about the Chanukiah that's in the background at Stark Enterprises in Iron Man 3.
Anyway,
I was just trying to remember which one it was. I think it's Iron Man 3.
I was like, you mean the thing that
the
started
one
the
with
MCU?
The
So we've been talking about the gear and the mentality and kind of the journeying. But one of the places that they're going or they refer to is the homeland, which is Jewish. I mean, Jewish people can resonate to the word homeland only because that is ingrained in the stories that and the culture and the history. And it does have a lot of meaning. And Rabbi, I wanted to ask how do you see this parallel with the Jewish homeland, which is Israel? And you don't have to get into specifics of, you know, the lands of the Mandalorian, but how does this show explore, you know, the ideas of returning home and the power that that is, and as well as like that the home can literally be wherever the people are?
Yeah, I think it's everything. That idea of a homeland and a connection to it is something that really brings people together in a lot of ways. I mean, from a political perspective, the power of a central and historic place to unite people, even across some divisions, even across sex is tremendously huge. There's a reason that Jews turn towards Israel whenever we're praying from anywhere around the world. I don't know much about Mandalorian religion, but I'd like to think from wherever they are in the galaxy, they are turning towards Mandalore when they are praying. And, you know, even for the spiritual side of things, you know, our connection to our homeland defines so much of who we are. We say that as Jews, as you said at the top, we're recording this the week of Yom HaZikaron, of Yom HaAtzmaut. And, you know, however people can feel or connect to a modern state of Israel, the presence of a historical land of Israel, of Eretz Yisrael, is everywhere in our tradition. I mean, you can't read the Torah and not come away without some connection to Eretz Yisrael, without a Jewish homeland. And that's a piece of who we are in everything. And we clearly see that in Mandalore as well. The people are everywhere. You can see the real shame on Bo-Katan's face when she describes how she lost Mandalore and how she essentially surrendered it to Moff Gideon. You can see how distraught she and the armorer, and I mean, you can't see it on the armorer's face, but you can really gather from how the children of the Watch approach everything that really this loss of their home world is this huge schism for them. And they strive to find any connection. I think it's back in season one where they say that, you know, once they were in the great forge of Mandalore, and now here they are in the basements scattered out in all corners of the galaxy without anything tying them together. And that's really the power of a homeland, is to bring people together.
And what strikes me is that the Mandalorians have not had any sort of flourishing in their exile. And they have not, none of these sects that we've talked about have managed to create a workable new version of their culture that can survive and thrive with or without a homeland. Jews, on the other hand, and this goes back to what I was saying about Din's inability to make a sin offering at the temple, right? That was a crisis for Jews after the destruction of the Second Temple, but we created a portable rabbinic Judaism that could live and thrive and flourish wherever we plant it. The Mandalorians have failed to do that, you know? But we have succeeded at this sort of like insane panoply of denominations that at the end of the day, like, we're not at war with each other for the most part in exile. I can't speak for what the Jews are doing with each other actually back in our homeland at the moment. But actually, my experience of exile is a great flourishing of Jewishness.
Right. I know one of the things that you've done, David, for the day is visiting a whole bunch of shuls or maybe you did it for yourself and you chronicled it in the J. I don't know which came first, but you've been around the shul circuit to see the different kinds of Judaism that flourish outside of Mandalore. I mean, you know, outside of homeland. So the question of, is Mandalore a people? Is it Mandalore a place? Is it a set of rules? We can bring in Aaron's Marvel fandom.
I mean, is Asgard a place or is it a people?
Or a people, exactly.
But like, can we just talk about that within the headpiece thing, who can take it off? And then, oh, and then there was the sword thing and technically you have to win it. But then they just decided to use Elder Wand rules from Harry Potter. And suddenly because the person disarmed the thing when the sword was somewhere else, now it belongs to someone else. And the only time I was able to just understand something, I was like, oh, Harry Potter.
They went fully to Elder Wand rules on the Darksaber this season.
By the way, Bo-Katan is still a worthy leader, even without the Darksaber.
Agreed.
You don't need Mjolnir to prove your worth.
Yes, and I think is perhaps like an even more believable leader without the existence of the Darksaber distracting her and everyone else. You know, people are so obsessed with it and what it means. And if it can just be gone, they can all just move on with life.
Because it's semantics. It's the thing that they hold on to without realizing that they never really needed it in the first place. She was always a leader.
It's more than semantics. I think it's symbolism. It's tradition. It's culture. It's a core myth that the people hold on to in terms of forging, I guess I'm using that term literally, their identity. I think a lot of people, a lot of Jews, I will say, in the United States have found that, yes, Mandalorian culture can be fulfilled outside of Mandalore and flourish as well. And that not being in a homeland doesn't mean that you are not an adherent of the faith, that you do not hold that history as shared. Or if you are a Jew by choice or a foundling or whatever the story is, you have chosen to walk among this people and those people shall be your people. And there's a lot of thriving elements to life in the diaspora. And I think it comes from agreeing to be there in the diaspora. I think if you're always moving and always trying to get back to the homeland, there's a sense of rootlessness, of wandering Mandalorians, so to speak, you know, going through deserts and being like, well, this is not really where I am. So there's no reason to move back because there's no reason to put down roots here because it's not for real.
You're saying this, and now I 100% believe that Mando is Tevye, but he's constantly going through life and his traditions and his what he thinks is true gets questioned, and he's constantly moving through and seeing different ways of life. And ultimately, he has a reckoning with his child, and it's a big moment. And I'm like crying through it. And now I'm realizing he's Tevye.
Okay.
But that I think is the key question in Fiddler on the Roof is how far are his kids going to push him? And I think we wonder in The Mandalorian is what's going to wind up with Grogu. Is Grogu going to become a Mandalorian? Are we going to put Grogu's head under a Mandalorian helmet, which would be a travesty. Let's pray that that does not happen.
Esther's over here in Grogu's mech suit, just hitting the no button on that one. No, no,
no, no, no, no. No. Look, there's so much bubbling in my brain, but since Aaron brought up Tevye, I have to skip ahead to this little note that I don't know if either of you picked up on, but my friend Harry Rubinstein, who's like just really on the popular culture beat, lives in Israel. He posted something on Instagram, and then we talked about it a little bit, that Jack Black, who is in that super kind of weird, like entertaining, but like also why episode of Mandalorian that had
someone called it the NCIS Mandalorian episode, and I thought that was hilarious.
Okay. I mean,
there was a literal zoom and enhance scene.
Zoom and enhance, yeah. There's so much to unpack in that episode in general, but the one thing that I think is relevant to this space is that Jack Black sings "Do You Love Me" from Fiddler, like in the background, and then there's the "Yes, I do." You know, there's just like a little giggle. But Harry said, you know, is this like some sort of secret audition for Jack Black to play Tevye? I know. Apparently, a lot of fans have always cast him in that role. And
fascinating. You know,
something that, yeah. So I think it's interesting. This is like a backdoor pilot for Fiddler, the series starring Jack Black. I just wanted to use the term backdoor pilot because I feel like that's Anyway, so I think that's really interesting. In case you're listening, well, you obviously you're listening,
you know, all the LA lingo, the Hollywood speak.
Well, Backdoor Pilot actually mostly comes from The Watch with Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald, which is another Ringer podcast. Ringer, you can't buy us, but you can try.
No free ads, Esther.
No free ads. Sorry. All right. But if you're looking for that clip, you'll want to check out The Mandalorian Season 3, Episode 6 at about 34:53. That's where the isolated lyric in question appears. Wow. So thank you, Harry, for also prompting me to think about that.
Shouts to Lizzo also. I mean, we can't say that scene and not talk Lizzo, please.
True, true.
Yeah, what a confusing thing for someone who was not into Star Wars. And then suddenly this mega cameo happened and I'm looking around. I'm like, is this a prank?
That they put Christopher Lloyd in an episode of Star Wars and he was the third most shocking cameo in the episode.
Well, he was the man with the DeLorean in The Mandalorian.
Wow. On that note.
I loved it.
Yes. Move it on. One of the other things we talk about in the Jewish community is who is a Jew? So the question of who is a Mandalorian is something that has come up also, because who can you claim Mandalorian identity if you don't cover your head, or if you cover your head sometimes, or if you weren't born to a Mandalorian couple? Are there Mandalorian couples? We don't know. If you were a foundling and you're a Mandalorian by choice, what if you have one Mandalorian parent? What if you consider yourself Mandalorian, but you never fully converted? Or if you have two Mandalorian parents who don't eat alone in solitary areas, or you didn't have a bo mitzvah?
Because the whole time I was getting so fixated in the who is actually the true Mandalorian. And toward the end, I was like, I don't think it actually matters. So I wonder how everybody else felt.
No, but I think that's what is fascinating about this approach, because a lot of science fiction conditions us to, I think in TV tropes, they call it the planet of hats, right? It conditions us to think of every race or every planet as having a defining attribute. So the alien planet where everyone always wears the same hat. Or, you know, in Star Trek, the aliens who are all super logical, or the aliens who are all really sneaky or whatever. And I think, it's easy to say that, like, each of these, you know, for the sake of narrative convenience, to paint each alien race, each planet, each culture as kind of one monolithic thing. But I have one of my favorite things about these three seasons of The Mandalorian is that they have fleshed out this culture in a much more realistic way. What are the different ways that you react to loss of a homeland? Of course, one of the crises that comes from that is, can you be of that culture if you weren't born there? With Din, we don't even know if Din was born to a Mandalorian family. At some point, he's orphaned, rescued, and raised by Mandalorians. By the sect that raised him, that's fine. They raised him as a Mandalorian, and he's a Mandalorian. It's unclear if other sects are as into the foundling life as the Children of the Watch are.
And interestingly, it's the really firm sect that's the Children of the Watch who are totally fine with that, whereas the more moderate, the Night Owls, our guy Axe Wolves, is calling that into question a lot more.
I think that's such a great point. Yeah.
But can we talk about that division for a sec? Because I think, especially in season three, it really is like he wasn't born this. It's like, okay, well, he hasn't taken his helmet off yet. And all of you are helmetless and you're all kind of doing your own thing. I had no idea what was going on. I was like, all right,
I don't
get it.
But I think that's interesting. They were the first Mandalorians you saw. And so you got indoctrinated into their nonsense about never removing your helmet. And immediately that's coloring the way that you're seeing other groups that you encounter in this fictional world. You're like, well, wait a minute. I heard those were the real ones. And I think that's interesting because when you get non-Jews, right, who maybe their only exposure to Jews or their only image of Jews is super from, as you say, you know, maybe all they know is like Shtisel and like Hasidic Jews. And there can become an impression among non-Jews that like, well, those are the real Jews though.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the psychology of all of that, that all of them are proud and all of them are defined by their Mandalorianness, that they all totally believe that they are doing the right thing and they are acting it correctly. And to me, that is all valid. And then what gets kind of familiar to me is when they start going, well, you're not enough. Well, you're not enough. Well, he'll never be enough. And it's like, well, that's kind of hilarious, the hypocrisy of it. Maybe it's the indoctrination of me seeing Mando first, but it's just always like, even in the first season, I think, you know, they're asking him why he can't just settle down and remove his helmet. And he's like, that's not what I want to do. Like, that's not who I am. And I think that's beautiful and valid in the same way that Bo can remove her helmet and be this middleman toward everybody. But it's when they fight or when they butt heads, you know, it's they're not acting together. I don't know. Rabbi, what do you think?
It's a very real tension that I think, unfortunately, I mean, we see in the Jewish world today, there are a lot of people who I think wrongfully and unfortunately will question people's Jewish backgrounds. Are you validly Jewish? Did you convert? Whereas what I think it should be, and we try to build that in my community, I can say at least, is that if you have converted to Judaism, you're in. Like, that's it. You are as Jewish as anyone else. If you have, to borrow the term here, if you have taken the creed, then you're in. You're one of us. If you have Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, if you have accepted the yoke of the commandments, you are in. You are a Jewish person, which feels a lot like these moments of our bo mitzvah, of this Ragnar, you know, getting dunked at the end and taking that official creed to really become a Mandalorian, whether or not you were born into it.
I wonder if there's anything in Mandalorian lore about treating a Mandalorian by choice with the direct line back to the Mandalorians of yore. You know, there's in Judaism, there's the concept that when somebody converts to Judaism, becomes a Jew by choice, that their Hebrew name links them back to Abraham and Sarah for the, you know, kind of in a way of saying, you are as official as they are. Like, you are connected to them directly, and therefore you are part of us directly. And I'm wondering if there's anything that happens during Foundling's adoption process, maybe we'll see it more with Grogu, that kind of links them back to, you know, the planet Mandalore and the original society.
Taking the creed and the sort of public recitation of it seems to serve that function.
Right. And what I think is really exciting is that as much as we learned about Mandalorianism, there's plenty we still don't know. A lot of this is all being written right now. Whereas in Star Wars canon, we've learned much more about the progression of Jedi and how you become a foundling, how you become an apprentice, a Padawan, and all this different steps in becoming a Jedi. We don't know that for Mandalorians yet. And hopefully that'll become clear as we get into future seasons, as maybe we see Grogu grow up a little bit more. He's got his first little signet of armor on his chest, which is amazing. And I want one of those, the signet as well as a Grogu, but in this case, just the signet. And hopefully that's something we'll learn as we keep going in the seasons.
Maybe one of those sales on May the 4th will work out for you and you can get one of those little signets.
You can absolutely get a Grogu. That's not a problem. Mine is over there in the background somewhere.
You say that as if we don't have one already at home in my kid's bedroom.
Well, there you go. And you're keeping it in your kid's bedroom. That's the problem. You have to need one of your very own. You don't have to share it with the kids. Anyway, this is not a plug for Mandalore merch.
No free ads.
No free ads. Right. We talked before about Bo-Katan's past and that perhaps she has repented from her more terroristy kind of ways. So the question of like, what process does she undergo to move beyond that past and to embrace a future? I'm wondering what the Jewish gloss here is, if there is any point at which we see that Bo-Katan has done teshuva, has done repentance, the active work of trying to be forgiven, and if there are other people in the past in Star Wars who have turned over a new leaf and that we might forgive and they might spend the rest of their lives or give their lives towards resetting the world in the proper way. And then I also have the halachic question, according to Mandalorian law, does it count that Bo-Katan actually ended up diving into the waters of Mandalore? Is this dunking because it was unintended to result in any kind of purification? Like, she didn't go in saying, and now I purify myself in the waters of Mandalore.
The armor seems to think it works. Yeah. But
right.
But the armor then quickly decides that actually, like, basically for like political and diplomatic reasons, Bo can take her helmet off because she has to go talk to regular Mandalorians who aren't crazy like us, you know? So I think, like, frankly, like, so much of what is actually acceptable in fundamentalist, you know, well, in any religious space is defined by what is politically expedient. So does it count? I would guess not, but the armor sure says it does.
Well, I would say that because she saved a life, that was an extra mitzvah. So
very good.
You know, I'm the one who accused Bo of being a terrorist earlier, so I feel like I have to redeem her a little bit. She did a lot of good. You know, she did leave Death Watch. She was not a fan of the Darth Maul takeover. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but despite being chopped in half and falling down a reactor shaft, Darth Maul was alive and well.
Somehow,
Darth Maul survived.
But a flesh wound.
But Bo was able to kind of leave Death Watch at that point and helped fight back against the Siege of Mandalore and really, probably one of the best pieces of Star Wars content that's out there. It's the final 4-episode arc of Clone Wars.
Phenomenal. If you haven't
watched anything, it's absolutely worth watching just those 4 episodes, if nothing else. So Bo does a lot of good there. She helps free prisoners and rebels. She really does get involved. So I think we can say she's done tshuva. She's really tried to build herself up. And once someone does that, we really try to say we don't necessarily remind them of their evil past. I won't get into the whole story now, but there's another classic Talmudic legend about Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Most of the time we talk about it to see what it means to be true chevruta, true study partners, to really see how you challenge each other. But in that instance there, well, by the way, they're talking about weapons coming out of a forge, Forge Mandalore. Mm. And what winds up being the key moment there is Rabbi Yochanan saying to Reish Lakish, well, you were once a bandit, so you know more about that than I do. And so he's reminding him of it, which really becomes a personal insult. So for someone like Bo-Katan, maybe we shouldn't remind her that she was a terrorist as part of Death Watch back in the day. Maybe we do look to more her recent ways of becoming a leader and trying to fight for good. You know, we can maybe compare it to Saw Gerrera, who was a character present in the Clone Wars, comes up again in Rogue One, where he meets his ultimate demise. And he's kind of this extremist. We saw him in Andor as well. And even there saw a lot of the tension between some of the more mainstream rebellions and some of the more extremist of the rebellions.
Hashtag Saw Gerrera was right. You know, the day he died, the rest Absolutely. Of the Rebel Alliance was like, I guess he's right. And we have to go have a war now.
I'm a Saw Gerrera fan. I've become such, but even he's someone like this who has done maybe some questionable things, but ultimately I think is good.
We have just taken our first step into a larger world, as some people might say. All right. So we have a couple of more things to cover before we sign off. And one of the things that I thought about was this category called Mando Potpourri, which I identify as the place where we can just rattle off a bunch of references in which we saw Jewy subtext without really talking about them too much, just like in a list. So I have a couple of things in this list, and I see that Howard also added some things to the list. So we'll run through them pretty fast, and then we'll do a closing question, which will be just very short answers from all of us about this text overall. So here we go to Mando Potpourri. I feel like we need a stinger. We don't have one, so I'll go, ba 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 ba, and then I'll say something like, no, squeezy, bad baby, or something like that. Okay. I also had an idea that Mando is the dove who brought back an olive branch after the world was destroyed. Mandalore was destroyed. In the flood myth, we have a dove that brings back an olive branch. In this case, it's Mando bringing back a vial of living waters to show that there was life.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Thanks. Also, there's the idea that Mandalorians eat alone was very non-Jewy to me, unless you're counting the instinct to eat in another room than your parent who's critical of your nutritional choices, not at all based on a true story.
Oof.
So, yeah, but Howard, you also said that there's something familiar about it here.
Yeah, I want to give actually a shout out to my friend David, who pointed this out to me, is there was something very familiar about maybe someone who's not familiar with the Jewish tradition sitting down at it for the first time and kind of looking around and being like, do I eat this now? You know, when do I drink this cup? You know, why is that bread covered up? And there is kind of that unfamiliarity that is really present if you're approaching kind of a ritual meal of some sort.
Oh, you're talking about when when Bo-Katan has to eat with her helmet on and she's like, how do we do this?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that, but that's awesome. That's right. There's also Din Djarin or Djarin from Clan Din. I don't know what we're doing with these names. Again, like I could got a bone to pick. But when a child reaches the age of mitzvot, of Jewish adulthood, their parents sometimes say a blessing that says Baruch Shepitrani, me ansho shel zeh, right? It's that this point marks the separation between my being responsible for this kid and him being responsible for his own stuff. So from now on, if anytime Grogu steals from the Shook or eats the frog lady's eggs or steals a blue macaron, it's his responsibility. So he's going to have to rein it in a little bit.
You know, it's also Din's responsibility, and I'm on the let Grogu snack agenda because he just needs snacks, guys.
Right. He's skin and bones. He needs to eat.
Why does he have to steal? Din's making the good Republic bounty money now.
That's true.
Buy him some snacks, man.
Listen, Rabbi Aaron Ben Moshe thinks that Din is taken after our patriarchs and fatherhood is a journey and they may not always get it right all the time and they're doing their best.
I'll start to worry if Din takes Grogu to another mountaintop.
Ooh. Oh, God, that was painful. So I also just want to talk about the names just a little bit here and then we'll do our closing question and... we look forward to having more scintillating conversations like this in the future. So the names, Din Djarin, right? To me, sounds like Din, kind of like God. Din is judgment. So I think that's a really interesting thing, even though, again, it's probably all coincidental. We are reading it through our particularist lens. And Djarin also sounds like Garin, which means like a nucleus or like a grouping. So it sounds like it's like the justice group to me. And Bo-Katan means, you know, we know Katan, it means small. And Bo, it means come here. So like, it speaks to me to the kind of incremental advances that she makes in her life toward leadership. Now, of course, she was named before The Mandalorian. I doubt that this has any resonance, but as Howard and several other people have pointed out, her father's name is
Adonai.
Her father's name is Adonai, which is God. And the last name, Kriz, to me sounds like Hachraza, about like Lehachriz. It means to like to make an announcement and to dictate something. So I think that that's interesting that the person is like the Lord of dictation, you know, that's kind of how I'm seeing it. And there, of course, are many names in Star Wars where we could get into the content of the names that are biblical and what they represent. Howard, I think you said about Rebels, there are a couple in there.
Yeah, several in Rebels, Ezra, Kanan, Kanaan, Caleb, Stephen Sikkin in our primary Mandalorian villain, Moff Gideon. Gideon is one of the leaders in the Book of Judges.
Right. There's obviously always more, but let's just have our closing question to you, our beloved guests, who spent so much time with us and generously gave of your heart, soul, spirit, and of the Force. So what benefit really is there to interpreting biblical texts through a contemporary lens or looking for echoes of religious meaning in contemporary culture? And I ask that you speak generally or personally, but briefly. Why don't you go ahead first, Howard? And then we'll go to David, then Aaron, then me.
Sure. For me, a lot of it is just an extra frame of reference. I think so much of the work that we do as rabbis, that I do as a rabbi, is trying to find ways of making our tradition, making our history, our culture accessible to people in the year 2023. And a lot of times that's easier said than done. And many different people have different entry points to that. Some people, it is the tradition. Some people want to sit down with a source sheet and learn the traditional text. but that doesn't work for everyone. And even some of the concepts that are described there, we struggle with some real life applications for. Now, does Star Wars give us real life applications, real life in quotation marks? I'm going to say yes. So yes, it's a long time ago, a galaxy far, far away. Yes, it's science fiction, but it just creates a better frame of reference for people to grasp these difficult concepts. I can say to someone, yes, Han shot first because Greedo was Rodef. Greedo was trying to come and kill him. So that's why it's important that Han shot him first. He knew he was in danger. He took it upon himself to shoot first. And you can use that as an example where someone can really understand the references. Someone can understand the background and really see how these situations might come up to then gain that fuller understanding of what our tradition is, what it can offer, what it can represent. There's always something to be said. Okay, maybe does this cheapen things a little bit? And yes, I think it maybe it does. But at the same time, if it's going to bring more people in and help people gain a greater understanding, then I'm all for it.
I love that.
You know, for me, I just think about, why are humans compelled to tell stories at all? It gives us fun and safe ways to deal with real and serious themes. And when you see themes that feel specific to your culture, your background, reflected in the story, the biggest stories being told in our media environment today, I think that's particularly fun and fruitful way to engage with themes that matter to you in, you know, fun stories that matter too.
I completely agree. I feel like pop culture was the way I learned about life in a lot of different ways. And it allowed me to come back and do more and deeper learning in a lot of different fields. And I feel like that's the beauty of entertainment and art, is that it helps you understand and express difficult topics with empathy. And I love that, even if it's Star Wars, which of all things, right?
I love that. And I love that culture doesn't have to supplant faith, and faith doesn't have to supplant culture. I think that both can bring important lenses to each other, can increase meaning in both spheres. All of us, to a degree, because of our involvement in both these worlds of fandom, fantasy worlds, fictional worlds, whatever they are, Judaism in whatever respect, whether it's religious, cultural, textual, ideological, certainly not ideological, like whatever your particular perspective is, there's an opportunity for each to strengthen the other. And I think that that's one of the things that we have going for us in the diaspora, where we in some cases are forced to do such things, to look at our Jewish practice within a cultural lens. But I think it also provides an opportunity for greater meaning. And that intersection really between Jewish observances and Star Wars observations, that's where we live here at the Bagel Report. And I want to thank you all for visiting us in this land of overinterpretation and meaning.
I live in the land of overinterpretation.
I know you do. I know you do. It's probably the most Jewish thing about you.
Well, thanks.
It's an honor to participate in this, in a great conversation. And let's do it again.
Yeah. Sounds great. All right. Thanks, everyone. And may the Force be with you.
This has been The Bagel Report, a production of Jay, the Jewish News of Northern California, and a part of the Jew Folk Podcast Network. Thank you to Lev Gringaz, our producer from Jew Folk, Inc., David A.M. Walensky and Andrew Essenston, and Danny Lipsky for creating our logo. You can find us wherever podcasts are listened to. Connect with us on social, on Twitter, at Esther K, at Eben Moshe, and at The Bagel Report. On Instagram, at Esther Kostanowicz, at Eben Moshe, and TBR The Pod, and by emailing us at thebagelreport@gmail.com. Now go and watch something interesting, and maybe we'll talk about it next time on The Bagel Report.